So tell me a bit about what you do and like what the type of organisation and things.
Well, let's see. I live in Oakland, California, and I have for the last 25 plus years, and I've been involved with women of color on the Global Women's Strike for about the last 8 years. I actually met women of color at the Global Women's Strike at a protest outside of the U.S.
Embassy?
It wasn't an embassy. It was a place where the representatives are housed, right? So, like the official, you know, the
what are they called?
Blah blahs. I can't remember. I can't remember shit anymore. Anyway, but anyway, so so I met them on March 8th in 2004, and that was shortly after President Aristide had been couped for a second time by the United States, France, and Canada. And there was the Global Women's Strike had organized an international protest of that coup. And Pierre Labossière was there as the primary speaker from Haiti Action Committee. So that was both my introduction to Global Women's Strike, women of color on the Global Women's Strike, and Haiti Action Committee, and really the issue of Haiti, because in spite of the fact that Haitian history has had a tremendous impact on all of us in the U.S., U.S. history for decades, I mean for centuries, right? Mm-hmm. It's not included in the history books. They don't tell the story of the Haitian Revolution. They don't tell the story of that impact in New Orleans and then throughout the South and, you know, the things that came behind.
The spread That's of not, uprising, yeah.
They don't want that story to get out. So
no.
So that's where I met, you know, like I said, the Global Women's Strike, Women of Color in the Global Women's Strike, and Haiti Action Committee.
And what are some of the ways that you've tried to highlight this?
Maybe you could say about your organizing.
Yes.
Because I think that would be more to the what we want to convey to the listeners is how we are organizing as women of color.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could say about the housing stuff and Occupy and.
So I'm trying. Let me try to find a way in.
Yeah.
So if how what's your time? What's your time like?
Oh, I've got like 10 minutes.
Okay.
And then I've got a scoot.
Okay.
Because I've got a baby to pick up.
Okay. Okay. So our organizing work is with grassroots women, and I'm a grassroots woman. I'm a homeowner who is currently facing foreclosure in the U.S., which means that basically the bank has been unwilling to help me find a mortgage, an amount to pay for my home that was affordable based on my income now as opposed to my income when I bought the house. And so I'm in a battle with the banks to beat back their attack on my well-being. So one of the interesting things is that I also work in a housing organization. That is an NGO, and so it's you know kind of ironic that I'm working inside of this organization, you know, and facing the same situation. But what I find is that in this housing organization where I'm currently working, it has an NGO culture. So even though there's some good work being done there, the fact that, you know, the NGOs were, that whole strata of organizations was designed by the 1% to protect their vested interests. And so even though we, those of us who work inside the organizations feel like we're there, we're trying to do some good in the community, blah, 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 it really was structured to protect their money and to manage the movement, to be a buffer between those at the very bottom and those at the very top. And so in spite of the fact that we do this work around helping people maintain their homes, both home as homeowners and as renters, the work of really taking apart the structure that makes us have to compete for housing in the first place, you know, on the marketplace, is not really challenged there, because the NGOs have really as their primary focus sustaining themselves. I speak about that not only from this moment in time when I'm in an NGO, but from a history of working in nonprofits and, you know, having to battle against the needs of the funders who want to and feel like they have the right to set the agenda for the work, which is often in contradiction to, or is definitely not in support of, and certainly not determined by the needs of the community. And so that's a constant struggle of figuring out how to have these organizations, which siphon off tremendous amounts of money, you know, their budgets are huge, and that a lot of that money just turns right back over into the hands of the 1%, because we have these enormous rents that we have to pay to stay in our office buildings, and then we have to pay their payroll taxes, and then we have to pay their fees for, you know, insurance and the various things. And so a lot of the money that really needs to go into the hands of grassroots folks so that our lives can, you know, be so that we can meet our basic needs, goes to support the structure of the NGO, which again just maintains the
status quo.
The status quo, precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you find the organizing back in the US? I've never actually been there yet. It's really like shocking actually, because I've always wanted to. I often hear about what's going on, like obviously now with Occupy, like what's the feeling there? I mean, you know, where you live and the battle you're going through, is the whole neighborhood like that, or is it just yourself? Because I know that it's a big rise in, you know, like repossessions of homes, isn't there?
Right, that's correct. So actually, by the time, by the end of this year, there are some predictions that the number could be as high as 12 million households that have been foreclosed on. And I'm not talking about individuals, you know, like 12 million people, which would be a lot of people. I'm talking about 12 million households, right? And so some of those households have three people, right? Those are families. Some have five people. So we're talking about, you know, untold numbers of people who are being foreclosed on summarily and kicked out of their homes. So, you know, Occupy has really been a spark. It's been such a breath of fresh air. Part of what I often say about how we became the 99% is that back in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was president, he came on television, because I remember seeing him myself, and he said, homelessness is a lifestyle choice, okay? And so that was a code, because for every year after that, the housing and urban development budget went down. And housing and urban development, that's our federal level housing policy department. And so they told us right then, we're going to be cutting housing. And every year, housing went down. So that's public housing, which is the housing that's for the poorest people.
Like
right?
Council housing here.
Right. So when that happened, those of us who had homes said, I have a home. So there was really no outcry, right, about what was being done to the housing budget for the poorest people. So 30 years later, the poorest people have been summarily disenfranchised from housing. And so they no longer fund housing as a priority, but they fund homelessness. Right?
And even the homelessness that they fund, a lot of it is going to these NGOs. It's not going directly into
the housing. Yeah, we were saying that, yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you have places like Washington, D.C., the capital of the country, you know, wealthy, has some of the highest homelessness, and people of color are amongst the most affected, and then elderly people and also other vulnerable people are the first to be thrown onto the streets.
Exactly.
So then how we became the 99% is now that they've summarily, you know, disenfranchised the poorest people from housing, they're on to people who have are higher up the economic pyramid.
Middle class.
And still have assets.
Yeah.
Because for working people, our primary asset is in our home. That's the main way that we build any wealth at all. If we get any to live on in our old age or to pass on to our families, it's in our home. And so when they attack our homes, they attack not only our financial assets, but also our health. Because without a home base, you know, like how do you care for your most basic needs, like sleep, like food, you know? So it's been really a vicious attack on the middle class. And so then the middle class began saying, oh, well, now they were 99%, which is good for us. So so that has been fantastic, actually.
Yeah.
When Occupy set up encampment on the lawn of the city hall in Oakland, I went down there. I was like a magnet. I was, you know, as much as I could get there, I was trying to go to Occupy because it was the most vibrant, creative, dynamic, just brilliant, you know, community I had been a part of. And it was clearly a housing colony because I spent some nights down there, but I did not set up a tent and move down there out of my house. Okay. So the idea that, you know, this whole, there must have been, I tried to count them. There must have been maybe like 150 tents. I mean, the tents were just like this.
Next to each other. Yeah.
I mean, there was a little path between, right? Yeah. And that's where people were living. They were feeding people 24 hours a day. There was a kitchen committee that was taking donations, and people were coming. Not only were feeding.
A lot of them were homeless.
Yes.
Themselves.
Yes,
they found themselves homeless.
Precisely. People who had become homeless because they had lost their homes, or their parents had lost their homes, so that young people who could not return after, you know, the military or college or whatever, they couldn't go to their parents' homes because their parents were now living with their grandparents, having lost their homes.
Overcrowding.
Yeah.
Precisely.
I mean, in London, we also took part, Women of Color was there from day one at Occupy, and we went down, you know, with our banners, and, you know, it was fantastic. And what we said, you know, the 99% is it's an anti-racist figure, and it means that we all belong together. You know, and of course, within the 99%, there's all kinds of sectors. And one of the things we've tried to do in the Occupy movement is spell out that women of color, children, rape survivors, sex workers, we're all part of that 99%. And we have to have our voice within the 99%. So it's like expanding the whole definition of who is the 99%. And that's what we've been doing. We've worked together. Like, for example, we did a Women of Color helped to draft a statement in support of Occupy Oakland because they have been viciously attacked by the police. People, you maybe could say a little bit about that, but people were locked up, thrown into cells, tear gas.
Yeah.
So we got together a statement which was then taken up by Occupy here and went out around the world, and people used it to sort of lobby the mayor of Oakland and call out the mayor who was involved in, you know, basically calling for violence against Occupy. But I think, you know, what we're really trying to do is to spell out women of color's contribution, because if we don't spell that out, the rest of the movement, you know, they think we're not there. You know, we're invisible. And they don't realize how much they need us, because to win, the whole 99% has got to get together. So I think maybe we should, there's one more meeting about, I hate to cut us short, but is there one more point you want to make now?
Can I just say as well, to listeners that are listening from this country, the UK tends to follow Americans' line, so 30 years down the line, we will find ourselves, like, already council social housing in this country, they're not building any more flats. I live in a council flat myself, and, you know, and so already an attack against the poor is happening, so we just have to look at America and have a look at what's going on there now. It will happen here very, very quickly soon after. Their fight is our fight, basically.
And that's why we organize internationally, because,
internationally,
the leverage, you know, it can be stopped.
Yes.
And also, we're better informed because they're already, like, the welfare reform that's being, and the cuts that are coming down here in the UK, they're bringing them straight from the US. And it's been a disaster. I mean, you know, women are driven, even women with babies, small children, are driven out to work for welfare.
Yes.
Poverty has increased.
Yes.
Deaths of young children have increased, especially amongst, you know, in communities of color. So it's been an absolute disaster, but they're bringing the same thing here.
Exactly.
And they're driving, you know, especially single mothers are being driven out of their homes with the rent capping. People are having to take their children away from schools to move to areas where they don't know anybody.
No family, no friends,
no
in those
nothing,
areas.
And start over from scratch. So it's exactly as Nell said, that is why it's urgent that we work internationally and that we start with the situation of women and children, because that is the way to get to the truth. And from there we can, you know, we can really build our way up and we can succeed, we can win.
Finally. Finally, no, I mean succeeding finally, that's what I mean.